relatively on sync.
I'm just relatively.
I'm thoroughly uncomfortable considering just skipping the cast altogether.
No, you're not.
That's
quit lying.
That's the king of stories, I tell you what. Hello and welcome to the EDH Reccast, brought to you by the best deck building site on the web for the Commander format, EDH Rec. My name is Joey Schultz, and I'm joined today by my lovely co-hosts. First up, the Speedster, whose article series takes you from 60 to 100, it's Matt Morgan.
Who, ironically, is not a relic of the past, like my other co-host.
Oh, next the man whose articles remind you to look in the margins and who is apparently a relic of the past, Dana Roach.
Hey, I'm just a future site. I've got nothing. That's what I've got.
I was going to say you're more historic. You're more historic than a relic.
Yes. Would have been good, yeah.
And I'm Joey Schultz.
The birthing
pod. Other the Commander Showdown series, this is one of our weirder intros ever. Anyway, all these articles and more can be found at edhrec.com, along with some awesome featured community content, such as other Commander podcasts and gameplay videos. EDHREC itself is a fantastic deck-building resource that compiles data from deck lists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new Commander decks. And, here on the EDHREC cast, we're going to give all that data a little more context. What is our topic this week, fellas?
Data.
Artifacts. Like me.
He's just calling you old. I thought that was supposed to be my job for both of you guys.
I got to pick my shots when I can get them in.
I guess, yeah. I'll let it slide this time.
In any case, Matt is right. We are going to be taking a look at some artifacts. On EDHREC, you can see that awesome theme tab to take a look at a whole bunch of different themes, such as plus one counters or infect. You can see different tribes, and we've gone over a few in the past about what the most popular tribes are. But for the time being, we wanted to look at some artifacts. When you look on that theme page, you can see that the most popular theme is artifacts. There are over 12,000 artifact dedicated decks on the site. So we wanted to take a look at those popular artifact commanders and see what's going on. We're going to tinker around with those. You guys ready?
Tinker is banned, isn't it?
Yes, and grateful. I'm so grateful that it is.
Ergo, I don't know how much tinkering we're going to do.
Alrighty, but before we get to all those artifacts, I have a disappointing announcement, guys. You know how on our Guilds of Ravnica set review, we thought that Lazav the Multifarious would be the top built commander? It turns out he's actually in third place. Wow. I don't think we're as good at guessing as we thought we were.
Why?
Yeah, Lazav. Well, you also said that Lazav would be the most
give
built.
Give it time.
And currently, he's only got 23 decks to his name, so that puts him behind Azoni Thousand-Eyed at 30 decks and Niv-Mizzet Perun at 37 decks. So these are early returns for, you know, the Ravnica data, but we are still losing a little bit. So just wanted to point that out because it makes me a little sad. But at least you guys are here with me, so we can all lose together, right?
We're a team.
No, well, kind of.
I agree with Matt. I think long-term, Lazav is going to have a much better chance of being number one than Niv, and did you say Azoni was currently winning?
She's in second.
Azoni's in second.
Second, okay. Yeah, I think long term, Lazav has the most chance of being the deck people are playing, but I guess we'll see.
It does feel very on theme for Dimir to like be not in the spotlight at number one, but like actually slinking around
sure,
in the shadows.
Right, exactly.
So maybe this is the Dimir victory. Also, Dana, I think you had a Guilds of Ravnica story to share with us.
Not really a story so much, but just a card like we touched on briefly during the review, which is Experimental Frenzy. And it was really popped up this week, even in price. It's gone up to like $5 or $6, I think it's at right now. So we kind of glossed over it a little bit. I think we mentioned it might be okay in, you know, Red or Boros. I watched some people in my shop playtesting Standard, and there was a couple Boros decks that were playing. And, you know, over the course of 15 minutes or so of watching it, I saw Frenzy come down, I think, three times. And the guy playing it ripped three cards off the top of his library with it multiple turns in a row. Now, granted, that's Standard, where like most of your cards have a lower CMC on average than you're going to see in Commander, because in Commander you're not going to be playing Lightning Strike and one-drop creatures that regularly and enough to, you know, do 3 or 4 of them in a single turn. But enough decks do have a pretty low curve, and in Mono Red or Boros, they tend to also oftentimes have a pretty low curve. I think we might have kind of skipped over that card prematurely. It feels like the kind of thing that we're going to be talking about for the foreseeable future as a really good card in Boros.
Experimental Frenzy. So that's the 4-mana red enchantment. Lets you look at the top card of your library anytime, and you can play the top card, but you can't play cards from your hand.
Yes.
But it also has like a 4-mana blow itself up clause.
Right, yep.
So really, you saw that one putting in work. That's surprising to me.
A shocking amount of work. Like, I was thinking, oh, you'll get a card here or there off it. And I was watching people just chain cards, again, in a standard deck, but I really want to see it in Commander. And then Dean Guti was posting about it. He's one of the writers at EDH Rec. He posted about it on Twitter today. And he also was mentioning Mad Blind Mountain, which is a card out of Shadowmoor. It's basically an ETB tapped mountain because it even has a subtype mountain on it. And you can spend one in a red and tap it to shuffle your library.
Red's got a handful of those effects.
Yeah, and it's on a land, so it doesn't suck up a card slot either. And it's a mountain, so it still triggers Valcoot, that kind of thing. It's still fetchable because it's a mountain. So I like that card a lot, too. I think if you're considering running one, you want to consider both. And that feels like the kind of thing that at some point is going to be really interesting in EDH.
All right.
I think it's got a lot of upside, but for EDH, I feel like it's going to be, there's a lot of setup involved to it. So if you can make it work, it'll probably be really, really good. I know Ari Lax, a pro player, on Twitter, he was singing its praises for Standard too. So I kind of saw the same feedback about it in Standard that you did. I'm still kind of torn about it for EDH, but if you have a way to just crank out, 5-6 spells a turn, then by all means.
Like if you're playing a Boros Angels deck or something and your average CMC is, 4.2, it's probably not going to do you a lot of good. But if you're playing, mono red goblins and most of your goblins are 1 or 2 mana, you're probably pretty frequently going to be able to play a land and then play a goblin or 2 or 3 off of that in addition to, a couple spells. I don't think it's a staple. It's not like Outpost Siege is the kind of card in Boros you can just blindly probably jam it in your deck and have it be a really good way to get cards. I don't think this is that. But I think the decks that where it fits, it's going to be really strong.
So speaking of Guilds of Ravnica cards that have to do with card advantage, a card that I don't think we spent any time on in our Guilds of Ravnica review, the card Underrealm Lich, talking about Guilds of Ravnica early returns, so far the data is showing that Underrealm Lich is getting put into 57 decks so far. This is the Golgari 5-mana 4/3 zombie elf shaman that says if you would draw a card, instead look at the top 3 cards of your library, then put one of them into your hand and the rest into your graveyard. And you can pay 4 life and give it indestructible and tap it until end of turn, which keeps it around. This... hot take, I don't like this card very much. I get why it's good. I especially like its interaction with Sylvan Library. I like that if you have no cards left in your library, in fact, then it doesn't mill you out and it just fills up your graveyard. But I don't have a deck that wants this. It feels like a lot of mana for this effect. And I don't know, this is sort of almost an early challenge the stats kind of thing, I guess. I should take my time on it, but as a dedicated Golgari player, I'm not sure that I want this card, so I just figured I'd ask you guys what you think about Underrealm Lich.
I think if my deck wants it, if it's got some particular synergy, like if I'm playing, black-green elves and I've got some reanimation stuff going on, then, hey, it's an elf I can block with and make it indestructible and have it survive, and it's going to get buffed by my other elves, and it's, going to let me do some top-of-the-library filtering, and it's an elf. So like I think it's if your deck has synergy that cares about it, or like maybe you're playing Sidisi, Sultai Sidisi, and you want to mill stuff to your graveyard to make zombie tokens, I think it enables a lot of things, but it doesn't feel like the card that you just put into a deck that isn't demanding those things be done. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think it makes the decks that are already doing this better, but it doesn't really bust into anything new. So like you said, Sidisi is gonna love this card. Just because there's blue, so you can play a lot of the card draw effects. So, you're getting multiple triggers from this Lich outside of, just during your draw step. I think the pay for life, it's kind of awkward. Like, it's not irrelevant in Commander. I know it's a big chunk in 60-card formats, but even in our format, it's not insignificant. Like, sure, you can block, a 10-power creature and, pay for life to get out of it. That's always a decent trade, but I'm not really a fan. I played against this at the pre-release, and I was more than okay that they were playing it because like they couldn't activate it because I was on the aggro plan. It was gnarly with like Surveil with our preview card, for example, They surveilled two, drew a card, and then kind of surveilled three, and they suddenly they had a huge graveyard. So like, if you can line it up that you're going to get a lot of triggers off of this, that's fine. But I don't think it's going to like make a new archetype or make random cards go up or see a lot of play for our format. I think it's going to fit into decks that are already doing this well.
Yeah, just when I revive something, the classic example is like Marin of Clan Nel'Toth. And like, yeah, this is good there. But I just feel like the stuff I'm reviving is already so much more impactful. I'm doing stuff like a Grave Titan or like a Grey Merchant of Asphodel. And I like the stuff that has an immediate impact. And since this one's more gradual, maybe that's why I'm a little averse to it. It just doesn't seem like I need that effect because my commander's already taken care of that. So I want my creatures to have the bigger impact when I do revive them. So maybe that's what's going on. It's not a bad card.
No,
I just I don't have a place for it personally. So I just figured I'd ask you guys.
It's not a Dana card. It's got a low floor.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about Underrealm Liches. We're here to talk about artifacts. So let's take a look at that theme page, the artifact themes. Let's first look at those top commanders. Matt, would you do us the honor and tell us what the top artifact commanders are according to EDH Rec?
I sure can. So we'll start off with one of the most played commanders of all time. We have Brea Aetherium Shaper. She is the no green 4-color commander, so white, blue, black, red. For 4/4, when Brea enters the battlefield, you create 2/1/1 blue Thopter artifact creature tokens with flying, and then you can pay 2 to sacrifice 2 artifacts. Weird, because she makes 2 artifacts. Deals 3 damage to target player, or target creature gets -4/-4 till end of turn, or you gain 5 life. Kind of a toolbox there.
Definitely a toolbox, but so is the next top commander for artifacts.
The next top commander, we have Duretti Scrap Savant, who I won't read because he does way too much. Third place.
Brea does more than he does.
Well, he's got ultimates, but Duretti is the mono red planeswalker that can be your commander. That is something that I will read. Third place, Sidri, Galvanic Genius, the Esper, human artificer. Fourth place, Shroom the Hegemon, or Hegemon. Or Pokemon, whatever you want to pronounce it as. And finally, in fifth place, Kozlek the Great Distortion, the Eldrazi Titan.
And I would guess the Kozlek one is probably a little bit of a machine misreading, just because the Kozlek decks tend to run so many mana rocks that it probably just kind of appears to be an artifact commander, but that's not really what the deck is doing.
Right, that's exactly what I wanted to mention as well. We went from so many colors like Brea and Sidri and Jerome and Duretti all the way to Kozlek, who... It's probably just because nothing but colorless stuff can put in there, and everything's going to be artifacts for that. So that is probably why Kozilek is showing up at such a high density. The other observation that I wanted to make, though, is that we have a pretty steep drop-off in terms of the popularity of these commanders. So Brea we saw with 2,351 decks, Duretti's in second place with 1,247, and then Sidri with 917, and Shroom with 707. So there is a bit of a curve going down there, because Brea is like, whoa, crazy, crazy, insanely popular.
One of the most played of all time.
Taper down.
Yeah. Well, and if we're going to exclude Kozilek the Great Distortion, we go from 707 decks to 426 to Arkham Dang Sun, who is the mono blue artifact commander of choice.
And Arkham's the first one that did not appear in a precon.
Truth.
Yes, that's a really great observation to make, actually. All of these are indeed precon commanders. Well, so Shroom was, of course, from Alara, but it has shown up in a pre-constructed deck, I believe in the Olero deck.
Yes.
And then it also, if I'm remembering correctly, showed up in the Brea deck as well, along with Duretti. They both got reprints there, too. So it's definitely gotten a lot of status that way. It's definitely been made more available, which is really cool. Do you guys have any general impressions about this first cast list that we're seeing for popular artifact commanders?
Well, saying that Brea, the 4-color one, is the most played shouldn't really be to anybody's surprise. She's been at the top of the top all-time lists. I believe she's number 3 right now. I know she's top 5 for sure. But yeah, not far behind Atraxa pretty much since that whole set came out.
I'm actually a little bit surprised to see Sidri at number 3. I thought she would be lower on the list.
I definitely thought that she would be lower than Shroom. I always assumed that people liked Shroom better, not just because it was a little bit older and therefore had a bit more prestige to it, but because the ability to revive an artifact for free can be just so powerful, whereas Sidri can animate your artifacts and then give them lifelink and death touch, which is cool, but has always felt a little, I don't know, off. She feels sometimes out of place, like she can only do one particular thing, whereas Shroom has an intense versatility of things to do. She can revive anything, which means your deck can do anything. And that's the observation that I immediately see here. Artifacts are one of the most open-ended strategies possible because, I mean, they're literally colorless. They're all just machine parts, and they, more than any other color, allow you to put, you know, take things apart and put them back together again in any combination, which is therefore gonna like wind up with weird, crazy, insane interactions that you're not gonna see with just some, you know, regular black cards or some regular red cards. These commanders all can go in a bunch of different directions. So Sidri feels to me like she goes in fewer directions, which is why it's surprising that she's in third place.
Were I to hazard a guess, I would guess that part of the reason she's ahead of Shroom is there's probably a lot of people that go to build Shroom, and particularly since Bray has been out, and just build Breya because it's kind of a better version of that same deck. And it's the same colors, you know, so it's Duretti's one thing. You're committed to mono red, and some people like that. But if you're going to go three-color Shroom, you're probably better off just going Breya anyway. Whereas Sidri is just kind of her own thing. There's no alternatives to what she does.
That's a good point, actually, yeah. And I suppose we should get it out of the way now. One of the things that is also kind of ridiculous about all of these commanders is that they have super intense potential for combo. Like Shroom, for example, she can revive a card like Sculpting Steel or Phyrexian Metamorph, and then that can revive itself as a copy of her, but then since it's legendary, it will die, which means it will come back because it technically gets the trigger of being Shroom and entering the battlefield and returning a target artifact to the battle. Like, it just can create a whole bunch of crazy combos there. Sidri is really famous for animating the card Aetherflux Reservoir, which is an artifact that allows you to pay 50 life and then deal 50 damage to anything. Well, Sidri can animate it, give it Death Touch and Lifelink, which means when you pay 50 life with your Aetherflux Reservoir creature and deal 50 damage to something, you get that 50 life back. So she just machine guns the table down. And then Breya, if you get infinite mana with Breya, she can just continually recast herself from the command zone and deal a bunch of damage to all other players. A whole bunch of these commanders offer crazy potential to just infinite people out of the game, which I think is something not necessarily unique to artifacts, but that is definitely a really big feature of artifacts. They tend to have that potential more than any other strategy.
Yeah, just like you said, being colorless means that they can kind of slide into any different strategy, and or you can get artifacts that normally wouldn't have gone in there. And now since they go in any deck, they join forces with all these other busted things and make some really weird interactions that, you know, people wouldn't have thought of 10 years ago when the format was, you know, kind of getting off the ground.
Right. So taking a look at some of those pieces that can lead us to crazy combos, let's look at some signature cards that show up really, really often in artifact-themed decks. When we scroll down on the page, we can see, surprisingly, three different lands show up in a whole bunch of artifact decks. Those lands being Darksteel Citadel, which is colorless and is indestructible and just adds a colorless mana, really simple, but that shows up in 71% of the artifact themed decks. Then there's also Inventor's Fair, that really cool Kaladesh land that can actually tutor up an artifact for you, and also Buried Ruin, which can revive an artifact for you. Inventor's Fair shows up in 66% of artifact decks. Buried Ruin shows up in 62. Those are really popular artifacts that it's just so simple to throw in there. That's really, really cool. And scrolling, if you'll indulge me, a little bit farther down, we've actually also got another land that shows up a whole lot in artifact-themed decks, and that's Seat of the Synod. That's the blue artifact land. All of these lands show up as really popular in signature cards, which is kind of unique. Usually lands aren't necessarily going to show up on theme pages, so I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge these four, because they definitely have to be pretty consistently valuable to show up as ubiquitously as they do.
They show up ubiquitously, and they do genuinely serve a purpose in those decks. Kind of the argument you hear about, you know, Reliquary Tower, for example, is it doesn't actively, like, change the state of the game. When you play Reliquary Tower, it's a colorless land coming into play that isn't probably doing anything other than being a safety blanket. And I like the safety blanket. I play Reliquary Tower. I enjoy being able to keep the extra cards I draw. I know it's maybe not good, but I like it. But I get the argument. Whereas when you're talking about like Darksteel Citadel, that's enabling Metalcraft or enabling Affinity in your deck, that's like genuinely a land you can play that, in addition to providing you mana, is doing something your deck probably wants to have done anyway.
Right. I think these lands actually kind of serve as a metaphor for the artifact strategies just as a whole. So you've got two artifact lands, Darksteel Citadel and Seat of the Synod, which are really popular in artifact decks. And that shows you that like artifacts care about having themselves, that like a large number of themselves on the field. Meanwhile, Inventor's Fair can go and fetch you an artifact, and Buried Ruin can recur an artifact. And all of the commanders that we discussed up above like all of those things. They like artifacts in huge numbers, like Breya. They like being able to tutor themselves for combo pieces. And then they also like Shroom, reviving stuff from the graveyard, which is exactly what Buried Ruin does. But those are just the lands. We've got some other really big powerhouse artifacts here. Dana, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of these other signature artifact cards we're seeing?
Sure. So the first one on the list that isn't a land is Darksteel Forge, which is a 9-drop, but artifacts you control have indestructible, and that includes itself. I mean, when that comes down in an artifact deck, you need to have a way to deal with that, or you're probably just going to lose the game, particularly if they're doing some kind of beat build, or it makes it really difficult for you to stop whatever thing they're going to do. You were planning on removing a key piece of their combo, whatever it is. When Citadel comes down, and it's pretty easy to hit 9 mana in a deck that's probably filled with mana rocks, you just have to respond to it. That 9 mana is misleading. It's pretty easy to hit, and it's just a back-breaking card. And it's in a lot of decks. It's in 12,000 decks.
Yeah, that thing's gross. I've been on the opposite end of a Darksteel Forge way too many times for my liking. And every time I do, I'm just like, oh, sweet. All of my removal doesn't work anymore.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and I think Darksteel Forge being so popular is one of the reasons that, like, Dana, for example, puts, you know, a decent premium. I don't think I'm out of line in assuming this about you, but you value exile effects a little bit more than destroy effects when comes to artifacts and enchantments. And I think Darksteel Forge being able to, I mean, it's very popular. 59% of artifact decks are playing Darksteel Forge. I think that's a pretty good signal onto why you should consider at least a few pieces of exile.
Yeah, the last time that I was up against a Darksteel Forge, I realized that I had nothing that could answer that person's board, and that my only hope was a fellow player's Merciless Eviction. Ugh. Like, that's a tough spot to be in. So that's a really powerful card, but we've got a couple more pieces too.
Yeah, well, after that on the list, the first creature we have here in the top list, signature card list, is Mir Battlesphere. Again, it's relatively expensive, but it's pretty easy to hit 7 mana if it's colorless in artifacts. And, you know, Mir Battlesphere just changes the shape of the game as well. It's a 4/7 creature, but that's not really what it is, because it makes 4/1/1 colorless mirrors when it comes into play, and it has the option to tap those mirrors when you attack to basically buff the Battlesphere and do additional damage to another creature or a person right in the face.
Can't hit a creature, it can hit a Planeswalker.
Planeswalker or a person, yep.
Yep.
But then, like, you have to respond to that. I mean, if a Mir Battlesphere is allowed to come into play and swing, in addition to providing fodder for Breya or fodder for what other artifact sacrifice shenanigans going on in a Duretti deck or
Correct Clan Ironworks.
Ironworks, whatever, mm-hmm. Right. It does 6 different things, all of which are a problem. And then after that, you move to Unwinding Clock, which is a whole different beast unto itself. Basically, you untap all artifacts during each other player's untap step. That's also a ridiculous combo engine that has to be reckoned with.
Especially when combined with the next signature card, also at 45% popularity, and that's Kuldotha Forgemaster.
Yeah.
5 mana, 3/5, tap, sacrifice 3 artifacts, search for an artifact and put it straight into play, then shuffle your library. Like, if you're going to search your deck for a Mir Battlesphere, you've got 5 total artifacts that you just got into play, Unwinding Clock on the next turn is going to untap your Kuldotha Forgemaster, which you can then sacrifice some of those mirrors that you just got to go get another artifact with just as ridiculous of an Enter the Battlefield trigger. Like, these pieces, they hurt.
Well, and I think that is why artifacts are such a popular theme. There is so much synergy. Like, enchantments don't have the level of synergy that artifacts have. I don't think anything really does. The way they work together in like this clockwork, it's something that you just can't replicate with other themes.
So that's a good theory. And that is one of the questions that I wanted to ask. So, Matt, why do you think artifacts are the most popular theme?
I think they do a little bit of everything. Like Dana said, they interact with the board differently than enchantments do. I think a big thing about that is they have tap effects, whereas most enchantments, I don't think I can think of one outside of like maybe an enchantment creature that you can tap it for an effect like you can with artifacts. So you say an artifact comes down, it can do something instantly, whereas enchantments, I think, tend to be more towards static abilities. enchantment or artifacts, excuse me, they come down and they can do stuff right away. It's easier to ramp with artifacts. You know, everybody talks about how they want ramp in there, which is a big thing that enchantment decks don't do. Like, enchantment decks need more help than that. They can't play just pure enchantments and come out okay like artifacts do. There's not really anything that artifact decks, you know, dedicated artifact decks can't do without, you know, a little bit of help. Maybe you're overpaying a little bit for some effects, but they still can do everything. And then they just synergize terribly well with each other. Enchantments, they need a little bit more help. Like, you don't have a Karrat Clan Ironworks type of card for enchantments. I think that's another big example, too. They just, it's more of a snowball effect, and they just, they're always impacting the board pretty much no matter what you do.
See, now, I like your guys' theories, but I feel like I maybe have a bit more of a cynical theory as to why artifacts are the most popular theme. This isn't like a very heartwarming way to put it, but I think that the fact that they're colorless is all that it takes, which means that they can go in decks of any color. So people can take any commander and put it in that direction because it's not difficult on your mana necessarily. When we take a look at the themes page, artifact decks, they show up in over 12,000. Like, there are over 12,000 artifact decks. That's so much, especially when you compare it to the next highest theme. The most dedicated theme, that's life gain decks, and there are only 6,308 dedicated life gain decks, according to the website. That's, like, less than half. And one of the things that I think hampers that particular theme is that life gain is the kind of thing that doesn't show up in many colors. Blue isn't necessarily gaining a whole lot of life. Red is not necessarily gaining a whole lot of life. Most of the stuff that you're going to be seeing there are things like Eili or Karlov or Obsidot or Olero. Those are the types of decks, but it is a little thinner after that. You can't necessarily do a life gain strategy everywhere. You've also got, like, wheels are a really popular theme. You don't have a whole lot of wheels in every color. Artifacts, they can go anywhere. I mean, I think the only color that really doesn't like them, like, specifically is green, but there's actually even a green artifact commander in the form of Glissa the Traitor, so green still gets to have some fun with artifact decks in that way too. So artifacts, just their colorlessness, I feel like that's what leads to their ubiquity.
I think part of the reason that artifact decks might be showing up at such an outrageous ratio compared to other themes, think about all, you know, for example, your Grixis decks, your Izzet decks, that they don't have green to ramp really. So in order for them to keep up, granted, yes, they probably have lots of card draw or the mono blue, but the only way they can ramp is through artifacts. So if they play, you know, a Sol Ring, a Signet, maybe a Lockets from the new Guilds of Ravnica, you know, they might play a few other things, then maybe just a few utility artifacts. Like, they're accidentally considered an artifact themed deck by the site, just because of the credentials that we have to put up there in order for it to pull.
I'm not entirely convinced about that. I believe for the artifact, for it to specifically register as an artifact deck, more than half of the cards have to be artifacts, which is why we're seeing things like Duretti and Sidri and Shroom and Brea, and we're not seeing a whole bunch of other things that are just, like, accidentally registering there. So, for example, you mentioned, like, Grixis. The only Grixis commander that actually shows up significantly on the artifacts page is Mishra, Artificer Prodigy, who does specifically state that he cares about artifacts. Then you've got things like Joyra, Weatherlight Captain, Muzio, Visionary Architect, Memnarch, Karn, Silver Golem, like all of the commanders that I'm seeing on this page, Kirkesh, Padim, Bosch, Akiri Lineslinger, and Silas Wren, Saheeli, like Jor-Kadeen, a whole bunch of them actually are showing up, I think because they are correctly being identified as dedicated artifact strategies rather than accidentally so. I think the only accidental one is probably Kozilek, just because it's colorless and therefore it's resigned to needing those artifacts.
Well, you kind of also, though, just called it out there, Joey, by naming that long list of artifact commanders. You know, prior to Commander 2018, what did we have for enchantment commanders that, like, actually cared about it on the card? Ural, maybe, which is a really, really narrow deck, and Kron of the Dawnclad, which is pretty terrible. Comparatively here, you know, prior to 2018, you know, Brea and Sidri and Shroom and Arkham Dagson and Muzio and Glissa and Joyra and Memnarch, and that's just the top of the list. Like, you can dig way down even deeper and find, you know, commanders that are clearly also artifact commanders, whether it's Padim or Bosch Iron Golem. That's a much, much deeper list for commanders that care about artifacts than it is for commanders that care about enchantments. And a bunch of those are really, really good commanders, too. They're not, like, bad commanders people are forcing just because they want to play artifacts. A lot of those are really genuinely strong. So I think it's attractive for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of the commanders. There's a lot of them that are strong. It tends to be very interesting interactive gameplay where you have a lot of moving pieces and a lot of things you're doing versus like Ural. And there's just a lot of artifacts in the game. I think there's all those factors come together to give us this most popular theme.
Actually, that's probably one of your best points. There's a lot of artifacts in the game. They dedicate, in some sets, just as much space to artifacts as they do to any other color when designing cards. So that's actually a really good point, too. Just their sheer number.
And I think one thing that kind of backs up that theory, now that, you know, now that my brain's kind of on it, you look at Creeping Corrosion, which is, you know, or Shatterstorm effects, stuff like that. Those are all 4 mana, very slow. They're sorcery speed, whereas M15 gave us Back to Nature, which was an instant for 2 mana. And they both do similar things. One is destroy all artifacts. One is destroy all enchantments. Artifacts are a little more central to the game than enchantments are. Pretty much every color has a way to do something about artifacts, whereas enchantments, not so much. At least with blue, you know, you can bounce different things, counter it, all that.
And black
kind of
can punish them.
Yeah,
black
exactly.
Black has a couple of cards that damage people for their artifacts. So that makes sense. There's a bit more interactivity there, too. So
yeah,
I can see why that would...
But yeah, just the answers for the two different card types, if we're just comparing artifacts and enchantments, it's kind of obvious they want artifacts to stick around a little bit more, just because those artifact versus enchantment sweepers, artifacts a little more expensive even.
Right.
We've also had multiple artifact themed worlds. We've had two blocks in Mirrodin, which is a heavily artifact themed world. We had Kaladesh, which is heavy on the artifacts. Even way back in the day, the second expansion set ever, Antiquities, is heavily skewed toward artifacts. Versus the closest you could call maybe an enchantment-themed plane is, what, Theros?
Maybe. Theros.
And it wasn't that integral to the game. I mean, the gods were enchantment creatures, but beyond that, there wasn't that much enchantment play compared to how much, you know, you saw of artifacts in Kaladesh or Mirrodin.
Yeah, I think that those are all really good observations. Regardless of the reasons why, artifacts are clearly a very, very in-demand strategy. And if it's because of how many artifacts they make throughout the game, if it's because of the color ubiquity that they've got, that they can just go anywhere, if it's because of any of those reasons, like, regardless, you're going to see an artifact deck when you're playing EDH. You just are. And so it's cool to take a look at this data. We're not done with all of the data, but we do want to take a quick break to go head to head. We're going to talk about some other statistics, see if we can guess some of this information, see how good we are at that, even though we're not necessarily good at guessing how popular Lazav is going to be from Guild of Ravnica. Matt, how about you start us off going head to head? Give us two cards and we'll have to guess which one we think is more popular.
I'm going to take you not one step, not two steps, but three steps further on how many cards you guys get to guess with. So, you mentioned how all the top artifacts, there's a bunch of lands in there, and you mentioned one of a cycle in Seat of the Synod versus its other counterparts from the original Mirrodin block. So, we had blue is Seat of the Synod, red has Great Furnace, white has Ancient Den, black has Vault of Whispers, and then finally blue has Tree of Tales, or green has Tree of Tales, I'm sorry. We know... just by the numbers from the artifact theme deck, Seat of the Synod is the most popular. What is the least popular of those five lands?
The green one is going to be my automatic guess, just because there are so many fewer green artifact commanders.
Ironically enough, I run the green one, and I don't run the red or the blue on any decks. But I would agree with you, despite running Tree of Tales in my Glyphs of the Traitor deck, I think that's probably correct, that Tree of Tales is the least played.
Well, sadly, you guys are all correct, so that was anticlimactic. Tree of Tales is only played in 2,438 decks, and I'm sure at least half of those are between Dane and I, with all the different iterations that he and I had of Glyphs of the Traitor. Number two, 8,732, so almost, what, three times as many? Almost four? Vault of Whispers is number four, followed by Ancient Den at 8,800 decks, and then Red with Great Furnace comes in at second place with 10,246.
Dang, that's pretty intense.
It's pretty disparaging to see even number four to number five. It's a little wild.
Yeah, and that is quite the disparity. I guess, though, like, artifacts do have those tendencies to lean much more towards blue and red, so it totally makes sense to me why those would be the top colors for them.
Well, it's also worth noting, I think, that Brea doesn't have green in her, and she is the most played artifact commander.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. Let's move on to my head-to-head now. I'm looking specifically in a Duretti Scrap Savant deck. Duretti, as we know, that awesome mono-red planeswalker, which means, since he's in red, he's going to need some ways to deal with things like enchantments. So, which of these cards has a higher synergy percentage in a Duretti deck? Spine of Ish-Saw, the 7-mana artifact that destroys a permanent when it enters the battlefield, and which returns to your hand if it goes away from the battlefield, if it would be sacrificed or killed or anything like that. Or the newer card, Meteor Golem, a 7-mana 3/3 artifact creature that destroys a permanent when it enters the battlefield. Which of those has higher synergy for Duretti?
I'm going to go with Meteor Golem just because of the recency bias, and it doesn't cost as much.
They're both 7 mana.
They're both 7. I thought Golem was a little bit cheaper. I'm still going to go with Meteor Golem.
I'm going to go with Spine. I think the fact that it recurs to your hand after you sack it is probably pretty useful. Although Meteor Golem thing in your yard is pretty good. It's ready too. Man, it could go either way, but I am going to go with Spine. It's such an old-timey, back-in-my-day kind of classic that I would guess it's going to be in more decks. That number might be different in 2 years after Meteor Golem had a chance to kind of settle into the greater meta that is EDH, but I'll go with Spine for now.
Alrighty, well, you are correct, Dana. Spine of Ish-Saw has 85% synergy, and Meteor Golem has 57. I find it pretty funny, actually, that you went with your I'm an old man guess there, because it just proves what Matt was accusing you of early on in the episode.
I just want him to stay off my lawn. That's all I want.
What? I'll come onto the porch, then. I'll stay on the sidewalk.
Right. We can whittle together.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was actually misspeaking when I looked at the percentages. So that is still correct that Spine of Ish-Saw has higher synergy, but it's actually at 67% synergy. It is showing up in 85% of decks. Meteor Golem has 41% synergy and shows up in 57% of decks. So I missed up my percentages. Sorry about that. But Dana, you are still correct either way. So congratulations.
I'll never forgive
you. As a reward, Dana, can you tell us your head-to-head?
My head-to-head involves Brea, Aetherium Shaper, our most popular artifact commander. She had, by default in her deck, two cards that allow you to bring back artifacts from your graveyard to play. One is white, open the vault, and one is red, trash for treasure. Both are very good cards, and both came in the deck but didn't stay in the deck. Both are in less than half the lists on EDH Rec. However, one of the two is more popular than the other. Open the vaults or trash the treasure. Which of the two is more popular in Brea decks?
Oh, this one's tough. So, trash for treasure, 3-mana red sorcery, yes. Sacrifice an artifact to bring an artifact back. Open the vaults, though. I'm having trouble remembering.
All players bring all artifacts and enchantments from their graveyard back to play.
I feel like EDH players are really reticent to let their opponents get simultaneous benefits from their cards, even in the event that they'll get way more benefits. Like, for example, landfall decks don't run as much Horn of Greed as they should, even though it draws them cards for the more lands that they play. Like, you get way more benefit from that than anyone else will, but there's still the hesitation for people to embrace that. So, since Open the Vaults gives equal benefit to everyone, even though it's really better benefit to you, I think it just reads a little scarier, which is why it would get less play. So I'm going to guess the Trash for Treasure because it's just a you thing.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Open the Vaults just because I have been destroyed utterly, completely, and entirely by it so many more times than I have by Trash for Treasure. It's just like the upside is so crazy. It's not even like fathomable until you see it in action. You know, it's great with like KCI decks. You just go over the top so far and beyond what Trash for Treasure does. Trash for Treasure is great. It's a very, very powerful card. I don't think you're wrong for running either of them in an artifact deck, but Open the Vaults just is absolutely insane. It does so much, so crazy powerful. If your deck is built to abuse it, which if you're running it, your deck is built to abuse it, I think Trash for Treasure is good, but Open the Vaults is utterly insane.
Well, I would like to note that Open the Vaults costs twice as much mana as Trash for Treasure. It's 6 versus 3 for Trash for Treasure, and it's 2 white mana symbols. So, before I looked up the answer, my assumption, in addition to what Joey said, was that, oh, well, if you're looking to make a cut from the deck, one of the things that I first do is look at those high CMC card cost cards. So I also was on Joey's side here that Trash for Treasure would have stayed in more decks. But we were both wrong, Joey.
That was correct. No.
Snap, dog.
Open the Vault is in 50% of Brea decks currently, and Trash for Treasure is only in 46%.
Got him.
Wow.
Got him.
Well, and to be clear, I don't think that Trash for Treasure is necessarily a better card. In fact, Trash for Treasure, I look at that one and I have to give it kind of a sideways glance because it can return an artifact if you sacrifice one. And yeah, artifact decks do like to have sacrifice outlets for their artifacts too. But I look at that one and compare it to the card Refurbish, which is the white 4-mana spell that returns any artifact without having to sacrifice anything. So, you know, I do kind of like sometimes just the clean, regular reanimation, but I'm totally on board the return all of my stuff train. I think that sounds just fantastic. I've used before the card Living Death and Twilight's Call to revive all creatures from all graveyards back to their owner's control. I love those cards because I like abusing them as a necromancer myself. And
there it is.
There it is.
Got your quota.
But when I've got the best stuff to reanimate, then I should play these cards because everyone else will get some effects, but I'll get powerhouse effects. And I feel the same way about Open the Vault. Like some other people will get a Soul Ring back or Commander Sphere back, or maybe they have their own, you know, Mirror Battlesphere. But you've got like 8 right. Mirror Battlesphere-esque cards. And so that just makes it fantastic. And so I'm... Just because I guess Trash for Treasure does not mean that I think it's the better card.
And there's also a blue version of the white card you mentioned, Joey, called Argivian Restoration. It does the same thing for 4 mana, 2 and 2 blue. Returns an artifact from your graveyard straight to the battlefield. So for 1 more mana nice. in those Brea colors, you could just bring it back without having to lose anything as well. So,
yeah, there's a ton of options for artifact revival. I think Roar of Reclamation might be another one if I'm... remembering that one as well. Like, there's a ton of stuff that artifacts can use. It's not just good artifacts, it's also good spells. And segueing neatly out of that, that's actually why we wanted to take a look at some other cool cards that show up very popularly in artifact decks. Other creatures, other sorceries, other things like that. So let's take a look at some of those. Dana, would you mind telling us a handful of the most popular creatures that we see in artifact decks?
I certainly can. So the first most popular creature, at least in terms of synergy, is Treasure Nabber, which in part I think that's because you have some recency bias there and it's in a brand new deck that people probably just put their list straight online. But that's the first one that shows up, followed closely by Foundry Inspector. Artifact spells you control cost 1 colorless less to cast. And number 3 on that list is Goblin Welder. That lets you choose target artifact to player controls and target artifact in that player's graveyard and exchange those two. So the graveyard artifact in the graveyard comes into play and vice versa. So those are kind of slightly different. Those all serve a different purpose in artifact deck. Treasure Nabber is kind of a ramp spell or gets you something to sacrifice to your KCI or what have you. Foundry Inspector is kind of a mana rock on a body in that your artifacts cost less to cast. And Welder does, you know, graveyard recursion shenanigans. So those all do very different things, but they all have own a pretty good chunk of the decks they can potentially go in.
I was surprised not to see Goblin Welder or the Foundry Inspector, but I was surprised to see Treasure Nabber being one of the top creatures here.
Yeah, I think part of that also, like, I don't think Treasure Nabber will be number 1 in 6 months or 8 months. Just I think that's a kind of a fluke of the numbers right now. But it is a really solid card. I mean, I do like it and think it probably does go in a lot of artifact decks, but I think it's probably less impactful than, you know, than Goblin Welder is in those decks, or Trinket Mage, which is much lower on the list, is in those particular decks.
Yeah, well, it's certainly getting a lot of help just from the precon effect. Just a lot of those decks that have been made lately since Treasure Nabber came out are artifact decks.
I mean, if people want, why I mean less impactful, if people want to play around Treasure Nabber, they can, and there's going to be games where you don't. People just don't have a ton of artifacts out, you know, by virtue of the deck they're playing. Goblin Welder is kind of always going to do something for your deck. It's just almost never going to be a dead card in the deck it's in. Whereas there are situations where Treasure Nabber just isn't going to do very much in some games.
Treasure Nabber is curious to me seeing it here. I actually kind of wanted to ask you guys really quick what your impressions have been so far of Treasure Nabber. It looks like a really exciting card to me, but so far I haven't seen it do a whole lot in the decks where it comes out. So I just wanted to get your guys' general impression of it.
I have not seen a treasure nabber in the wild yet. I'm sure it's very powerful. I think it's kind of funny because everybody was hyping treasure nabber to be, you know, the vintage playable eternal format, whatever. I have not seen anybody at all playing treasure nabber since it was released.
I've seen two of them in game. I think I've seen it cast twice in a game. And both times it was fine. It, you know, kept me from tapping a soul ring one game, and it slowed up somebody else for a, you know, a turn or two till somebody removed it. But nobody tapped anything with it on the field. So basically it was kind of a, you know, aura of silence kind of effect. It kind of chilled everyone out for a turn till someone deleted it. But it didn't steal anything because no one was in a position where they like desperately had to tap those artifacts for mana in order to make a thing happen. They just waited it out until someone removed it. It's a fine card. I think it's much easier to play around in Commander than it would be in a different format where you can't afford to just not tap your artifacts for a turn.
Right. So far, the impression that I've gotten from it is that it's much more of a deterrent or almost like a temporary land/artifact destruction spell than it is an actual mana accelerant itself, which has been pretty interesting. Although, for the record, the combo that I do really, really like with Treasure Nabber is also having a Mycosynth Lattice on the battlefield, because then all of your opponent's lands become artifacts, and when they tap their lands, you would get control of them. I think that's really, really boss.
Mycosynth Lattice is just busted in general. Right, like, you can name like three-quarters of the yeah. cards on this list you can name, and like, and it also is really good with Mycosynth Lattice. It's like saying that you know, stuff is good with Paradox Engine. It's just busted cards are going to be busted.
If you're resolving a Lattice, you definitely have some way to just win that game without, you know, needing to take lands with a Treasure Nabber.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think just the other impression that I want to give about Treasure Nabber is that it so far seems to be more of a, this is a card for red decks than it is, this is a card for artifact decks.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, and actually, I got so excited to ask about Treasure Nabber that I forgot to mention some of the top cards that we're seeing here on the Artifact theme page. We discussed some of these signature cards, such as Darksteel Forge, things that are definitely a lot more dedicated specifically to Artifact decks, but there are also some very popular cards in Artifact decks that show up in a whole lot of other places, too. Cards such as Solemn Simulacrum, which shows up in 61% of Artifact decks so far. Then there's also Thran Dynamo, really powerful mana rock, in 45% of Artifact decks. Mindstone shows up in 42%. Voltaic Key, interestingly, is not a signature card, and that shows up in 42% of Artifact decks as well. What do you guys make of some of these top cards that we're seeing?
I think they're just generically very powerful. Granted, maybe, you know, kind of started to get outclassed a little bit. Like, Thran Dynamo, yes, it basically costs you one mana to get down on that turn, but people talk about Power Creep and Solemn Simulacrum being just, we've said it on the cast a few times even, like, it just doesn't hold up to a lot of the power of new cards coming out. It's just kind of living off its reputation at this point. Voltaic Key, obviously still crazy powerful. It's a combo piece, kind of a Unwinding Clock light, if you will. I really like Wyrmcoil Engine. That's one of my favorite creatures for artifacts, or just a creature in general. That's the next card that we would hit. But it's just a lot of ramp, and then just the top four, at least I think, are kind of living off reputation.
Well, they're also creatures that you can just put into every single artifact deck, and you're probably going to get some synergy, as well as having them be really useful. Steel Hellkite, you know, you can just jam that into any deck and have a very good chance of just killing somebody if it goes around the table one turn, or you have a way to give it haste. In addition to that, because you're playing an artifact deck, you probably have a bunch of ways to recur it if someone doesn't exile it when they do kill it. So I think a lot of these, whether it's Wyrmcoil or Steel Hellkite or even Solemn in an artifact deck, I think Solemn is definitely overplayed and has been outclassed in as like a generic value card you're going to run. But I think an artifact deck where you're probably going to be doing shenanigans with it, maybe it's still pretty solid. So I think a lot of these are cards that do a thing that's a really useful thing, but because they're artifacts, the deck has synergy with them in ways that a normal deck doesn't.
Yeah, these top cards, we've got Thran Dynamo, you mentioned Steel Hellkite shows up, Gilded Lotus also shows up here. So a lot of it is just top cards. These are cards that anyone can take advantage of, which is really great. That means that they're going to be the powerhouse stuff, and Wyrmcoil Engine definitely fits the bill. If not that, then fixing your mana is something that a lot of decks that don't run green are going to need. So that explains, in my opinion, why we're getting so many mana rocks and such among the top cards. Let's move on now, though, just from those artifacts. We've got a couple of other non-artifact things to handle. The instants and sorceries are pretty interesting to me. I think we can knock out sorceries really quick. The most popular sorceries that we see for artifact decks are things like Fabricate, Scrap Mastery, Echo Storm is a new one, Trash for Treasure, and Open the Vaults are on there, too. All is Dust is a really fun one because it makes everyone else sacrifice all colored permanents they control, which means your artifacts are nice and safe. But the sorceries are just super artifact-y spells, which is basically what you'd expect. The instance is where it gets a little weird for me, though, and that's what I kind of wanted to linger on. When we look at the most popular instance for an artifact deck, the number one is War of Invention. This is the X blue 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 card from Kaladesh with Improvise. It's an instant, and therefore Improvise lets you tap extra artifacts to help reduce that cost or help pay extra mana for that cost. And it will search your library for an artifact card with a converted mana to cost X or less, put it onto the battlefield, then you shuffle your library. So it's sort of like a more expensive instant speed Fabricate. Really, really cool. Another super obvious artifact spell. But after that, when we look at the instants that show up most often in an artifact deck,
Snooze
we've got Siphonic Rift, Counterspell, and Chaos Warp. What?
Snoozefest.
I just wanted to get your guys' take on these specific spells. They're just some of the most popular spells that we see generally in decks of these colors.
I think it's worth noting that there just aren't very many instants in general that register, you know, high enough for EDH Rec to pick it up. And they're just generically good cards. Like, of the top 7 instants that show up on artifact theme pages, well, there's only 7. 4 of them don't have anything to do with enchant or artifacts. It's just generically good cards. Only 3 instants have anything to do with artifacts. You got War of Invention. Number 5, you have Enlightened Tutor. And number 6, you have Thirst for Knowledge. Enlightened Tutor, obviously, it's 1 white for a tutor for an artifact or enchantment. Thirst for Knowledge is a instant for 2 and a blue, draw 3 cards, discard 2 cards, or discard an artifact. So, but the other ones, it's like you said, Cyclonic Rift, Counterspell, Chaos Warp, and then Swords to Plowshares. Those are all just generically good cards. I think it just kind of lends to instants don't really have a whole lot to do with artifacts, or just artifacts synergize so well you don't need a lot of instants to make the deck better because you're already compounding all the artifacts on each other to begin with.
Right, that's what I wanted to ask. What do you think this particular shortage of instants reveals about artifact strategies? Dana, what are your thoughts?
Well, if you showed someone this list and said, okay, which of the themes in EDH Rec do you think this is from? I don't think anyone would guess artifacts other than maybe, like, Thirst of Knowledge might be the only card that gives it away because it actually wants to be in a deck where you would have a extraneous artifact to discard that you don't care about pitching. But even that is just a pretty decent draw spell at instant speed. So I think that's kind of what Matt mentioned. That's the first thing I think of when I see this is these are just cards that don't say artifact deck to me. They just say cards that you'll put in any deck.
Yeah, they're just the things that grease the wheels, I guess.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, maybe I feel like I'm a little disappointed by that. When we look at any of the other categories, the most popular enchantments in Artifact X, for example, we get stuff like Storm the Vault and Thopter's Bio Network, which are like hyper synergistic with artifacts. When we look at the most popular Planeswalkers, we get things like both Tezzerets and Ugin the Spirit Dragon even shows up, and that's because he has great synergy with stuff that's colorless. And then when we take a look at lands, we also see things like Academy Ruins and all of those artifact lands and things like that too, which are just so much fun. But the instances where we get some pretty generically just whatever stuff and there's not a whole lot of time dedicated to it. I guess I was also just kind of curious if, sort of like Matt was mentioning, there's something sorcery-esque maybe about the way that artifact decks work. It's all going to be very much on your turn. Because you're playing so many artifacts, you don't have a lot of opportunity to hold up mana very often, which means that you have less desire for instants in your deck, because you frequently have to pay those huge mana costs for those great big pieces of metal. But, I mean, there are workarounds for that, things like Vedalken Orrery, obviously. But, I don't know, I'm just wondering if that has something to do with it, or if I might be missing it completely, and it turns out that the artifacts themselves can do so much stuff at instant speed already, things like Breya's activated ability and Sindri's activated abilities, for example, then maybe that's why they don't need as many instants in their deck, because the instants that they do need are just going to be classic, whereas the deck is already doing enough stuff in that slot already.
Yeah, I don't think they need that much more help to be the most popular. I mean, if they had more instant speed interaction, I think it would just kind of corner the market. Yeah, I think it's fine that they have to move it at sorcery speed every now and then, just because they're doing everything so well anyways.
And I think that's not anything that's unique to artifact decks, really. Like, if you go over and do the same thing and look at the instant spells that most show up in enchantment decks, nothing on that list jumps out as being remotely enchantment-related. Like, the top ones are Teferi's Protection, Anguish Unmaking, Path to Exile, Rift, Utter End, Eladrami's Call, and Return to Dust. None of those remotely scream artifact or enchantment deck to me. If you look at the, you know, the theme page for plus one counters, there's, you know, Abzan Charm, I guess, in that list might indicate that's what it is. But it's the same thing. It's Mortify, Rift, Krosan Grip, Beast Within, Anguish Unmaking. So it seems like for theme decks, just in general, whether it's artifacts, enchantments, plus one counters, life gain, those slots just go to utility cards.
That's a good point. It says a lot less about the nature of the theme than it does about the nature of instance.
Yeah, I think so.
That's cool. All right, that was very edifying for me, so I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's finish up by talking about the most popular artifacts that show up in artifact decks. There, we've talked about a whole bunch of them before that show up as signature and top cards and things like that, but there's also, on this artifacts page, a artifacts section that we should touch on really briefly. The top four most popular non-signature, non-top artifacts of all time artifacts that show up on this page are Mana Rocks. Those top four are Sol Ring, Basalt Monolith, Hedron Archive, and Commander Sphere. Pretty obvious Mana Rocks, of course, but there's a couple more down there that we also want to take a quick look at. So, Matt, what are some of these other artifacts we're seeing?
So the first one that we see that isn't a Mana Rock is Mirage Mirror, which is a really interesting choice. Just because it does a little bit of everything. It's just 3 mana, pay 2 mana. Mirage Mirror becomes a copy of target artifact, creature, enchantment, or land until end of turn. So it kind of becomes really whatever you need it to be, and it's not even limited to your own stuff. Followed after that, the legendary artifact in multiple ways. Paradox Engine. Everybody knows how crazy that card is. Followed by Skull Clamp, Sculpting Steel, and then Mirror Works.
So this is a pretty interesting cast. What do you make of these other popular artifacts?
Paradox Engine, I mean, should surprise nobody. We talk about how artifacts, just the card type in general, they do a lot of stuff at instant speed. So make some mana, cast some spells at instant speed, untap everything, go crazy. That doesn't really surprise me. Like I said, Mirage Mirror being that high does, though. It does have a nice kind of parallel with Sculpting Steel, how it's kind of becomes a copy of whatever else you need it to be. Mirage Mirror, obviously not being limited to your own stuff, and you can do something different every turn, does give it a lot of play, a lot of interaction, a lot of instant speed interaction, again. But that was kind of surprising to me. That shows up in 35% of all artifact decks.
So here's the problem, though, with Mirage Mirror, and this is something I've experienced more than once. Mirage Mirror is so useful, and you can do so many things with it, that it almost becomes distracting when you have one out, because you're looking around at all the different cool things you can do that no one's ready for, and you start just focusing on, like, showing off with Mirage Mirror. At least I do sometimes. Like, I literally get distracted by just wanting to, like, find what the weirdest thing I can do with Mirage Mirror is.
Well, that might be something more about you than
maybe.
It is about Mirage
it's
Mirror.
A great card. It is a like it is a ridiculously powerful card. I'm not surprised it's in 2,800 decks. It should be in more than that, I would think, based on power level and utility. I'm just a huge fan of it, and it's the kind of card that, like, if you told me Mirage Mirror was in your deck, there's almost any deck you named, I'd go, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess my impression about these final artifacts, the ones that seem to probably, you know, fill up the rest of the 99 in these artifact decks after taking a look at all of the other really powerful synergy cards that we see, these are just kind of the best at what they do, but they're also, and I'm going to use a hyper-scientific word right now, they're also fiddly. And that's kind of the impression that I get about artifact decks generally. I don't tend to play them a whole lot, so this is a more of an observer opinion than an actual pilot's opinion. But artifact decks tend to be doing just constantly a bunch of stuff, a bunch of minor stuff here and there, which will then eventually culminate into a victory, rather than some other strategies like playing a Craterhoof and then swinging. Like, artifacts are much more about the minute processes that will eventually lead you towards victory. And things like Skull Clamp definitely add towards that. It's a tiny investment now that gets you a huge payoff, and then you can continue to use that over the course of the game to accrue constant value. Things like Paradox Engine, like you have to know all of the stuff that you're doing. You've got like 13 pieces moving at once to do that. Mirage Mirror requires a hyper-focused attention on the stuff that it can turn into. Sculpting Steel requires you to also pull into it. Mirror Works also requires a bit of setup for it. Like, a lot of these cards just strike me as being the kind of thing that you have to do a whole lot to make sure that they do their thing. And then once you do, it's insurmountably awesome. But that's just, they sort of speak to me on that level. Like, this gives me an impression of what artifact decks are doing. They are fiddly. They're not the other stuff that I personally tend to prefer to play, which is things like Reanimator, which is just like discard and then resurrect and big smash, or other green decks that are also going to do that big smash thing, or life gain decks, which are just going to be like exploding with high life totals. Artifact decks are doing something on a very different dynamic, which I think is pretty cool, but is also just not the personal type of thing that I like to see. But that's just what I'm getting. That's my impression that I see from a lot of these cards.
Well, I think I described artifact decks really early on in the show as kind of being a clockwork where you have all these moving pieces working together.
Right.
Well, that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is what you described, where you're just dirtling for, you know, a 10 minute turn, getting nothing accomplished, flipping your artifacts in and out of the graveyard, doing that kind of thing, which is absolutely like a legit thing I've seen as well. So the upside is that interaction, that fiddling, can be fun and it can be really effective, and it can be really boring to watch, and it can be also really time consuming while you get nothing done if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, you're untapping with your Voltaic Key to do your Cold Oath of Forge Master to get a thing, and then you're unwinding clock, and then you're going to trigger your Thopter Spy Network. There's a whole lot of mini stuff that can definitely add up to a huge amount of value, but that I keep on using that word fiddly. It's not very original, but that is the thing. So my point is to agree with you. There is that danger, and so I like that. To acknowledge that particular impression, that way we can make sure that we steer clear from that danger, and that we make sure that the deck actually, like, you know, gets the final punch in, because sometimes I like a great big punch.
I am in agreement.
Same here.
I wonder if Matt is. Oh, he is. He is in agreement. Matt just likes punching things.
I do like punching things. Well, I mean, I like the combat step, so of course I like punching things. So.
And yeah, I would guess Matt, who I know is a Glissa deck as well, that's definitely an easy trap you can fall into with Glissa, where you just spend a lot of time goofing around, sacking artifacts, bringing them back. And if you don't know how to do that correctly, you can waste a whole lot of time and not get anything done.
Yeah.
But if you do, you can combo people out,
sure,
all to high heaven.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it kind of goes back to like how I built my Moldrotha deck, for example. Like, you can only do so much, you know, spinning your wheels until you actually have to find something that's going to win you the game. On the other hand, like, I built a mono white Tashar deck that's, you know, KCI, Karak Clan Ironworks, where you just sacrifice a bunch of stuff, open the vaults, make infinite mana. And so, yes, there's a lot of like Rube Goldberg, you know, this makes this happen, which makes this happen, which makes this happen. But then with infinite mana, then you go out and win the game after that. So I do agree, you know, you can do so much cool stuff, cool interactions, whatever. But like, if it's not winning you the game, what's the point? You know, solitaire's fun only for so long.
But Rube Goldberg is another great term to use for it. And maybe that's what I'm trying to ruminate on right now, is just that artifacts feel like artifacts should. In this actual game, their mechanics do feel like a machine, which is pretty awesome. I don't think every game necessarily achieves that. I think some games, they'll bring forward like, ooh, this is a metal crafter character, but it doesn't feel like one. Or this is a rogue, but he actually behaves a bit more like a berserker or something. There are just some games where they try and install a bit of flavor into their game mechanics, and it doesn't necessarily translate. So I'm proud of Magic that it super does. This definitely feels like a machine, and they're really awesome interactions. Let's finish up now by challenging some stats. We've been looking at a whole bunch of artifacts, which means now we've got to challenge some of the numbers that we're seeing for them. So to wrap things up, Dana, what's your challenge to stats this week?
My challenge to stats is one of these artifacts, but I'm kind of talking about it more in a generic sense. That's a Voltaic Key. Voltaic Key, for those that don't know, is a one mana artifact, and you can spend one and untap target artifact. So I'm not going to necessarily argue that it's in too many or too few decks, but I did encounter a situation a couple weeks ago with a friend of mine who was playing his Brea deck, and it's not a combo deck. He generates value, but he usually wins through various forms of creature beats, and he played a Voltaic Key pretty early in the game, and I spent a minute or so trying to figure out what he might have added to the deck based on knowing what's in his list, what he was going to do with it, like what combo it had. And I asked him a few minutes later, like after the game wrapped up, what is the key in the deck for? And he pointed out that, oh, I've got 11 mana rocks in this deck that tap for two or more mana. So essentially in that deck, Voltaic Key is a one mana artifact rock. If you have something that taps for two mana, you can use one of those mana with Voltaic Key to untap it and tap it again. It essentially, if you have any of his artifacts out, it's a one mana rock, which I had never ever thought of.
I like that. Yeah. That's a really good way to look at it. Yeah. All you need is something. Yeah. I'm on board.
So even if you're not running combo, if you happen to have a deck, whatever deck it is, where you have a whole bunch of mana rocks that tap for two, it's something to consider. You know, instead of running another bad mana lith or something in the three mana slot, if you're running, you know, Warm Power Stone and Thran Dynamo and Gilded Lotus and your Soul Ring and, you know, Crypt and Vault and whatever, if you have that many artifacts that tap for multiple mana, take a look at Voltaic Key. It winds up being essentially a cheap mana rock as long as you have mana rock out.
All right, that's a really cool pick, Dana. I like looking at it that way. That's really cool. And heck, if it also gives one of your happens to be an artifact creature's vigilance as well, yeah, you know, that ain't the worst case scenario either. So
and
that's
a
cool pick.
If you happen to have a Time Vault, then you win.
If you happen to. Is that even legal in our format? I don't even want to know. Artifacts are crazy.
What Sheldon doesn't know can't hurt him. So just play it.
Wow. Alrighty, let's move on now to my challenge of stats, and I'm talking about a spell here, one that I think does deserve to see a lot more play in a specific artifact deck, so it actually has nothing to do with artifacts, though, so bear with me, guys. Y'all know the new Saheeli, the Gifted. She's really cool, and one of her plus one abilities is to reduce the cost of the next spell that you play by one for every artifact you currently control, which is bonkers cool. You can play things like Darksteel Forge, which are 9 generic mana, for basically free if you're already doing well, because it just reduces that cost from 9 all the way to 0. But she doesn't just do that for artifact spells, she does that for things that have X in their cost as well. So my challenge to stats is going to be in a Saheeli deck. I think the card Comet Storm does not show up nearly as much as it should, which is to say it doesn't show up on her page at all. So, for those that don't know, Comet Storm is a 2 and an X instant, that's 2 red mana, and X, for an instant with multi-kicker. It says to choose target creature or player, then choose another target creature or player for each time Comet Storm was kicked. Comet Storm deals X damage to each of them. If Saheeli is reducing the cost of your next spell by, like, 10, 9, or, heaven forbid, like, 20, Comet Storm can be an absolute blowout. That is a win condition right there, because Saheeli just produces so much extra mana for you to make a huge blaze effect that can be multi-kicked to wipe out multiple players. This is, in that deck, Red's version of Exsanguinate. You don't gain life, but your opponents do lose it, and that's why I definitely think that it deserves to be put into Saheeli decks. It's not an artifact, it just works really well when you have a ton of them. So I think that deserves to see play in Saheeli. Right now it doesn't show up on her page at all. Just think that's wrong.
I would agree with that. I like that.
That's fair. I mean, it's a good way to deal a bunch of damage and, like we keep saying, win the game.
Yeah, it kind of solves that lack of a win condition problem you sometimes have with decks that are fiddly like that as well.
Yeah, it's just a total blowout. And I like that it's a secret synergy with that particular commander. I think it does a whole lot of work. And frankly, just X spells generally. Like, you don't want to put too many X spells into the deck because you don't want to dilute away from all of the actual artifacts. But things like Stroke of Genius or Mindspring could also totally go into a Saheeli deck because they can draw you a ton of cards because she'll reduce that X cast by a whole ton. So definitely take a look at some of those spells for a Saheeli deck, because they may not be artifacts, but she's going to love you if you cast them. Matt, what's your challenge to stats?
So I have a question for you guys. What if I told you you could draw 9 cards for 4 mana? Would you play that card?
Yeah. Yes, I would.
I would probably do that as well.
What if you only drew 7 cards for 4 mana?
I'm still on board.
I'm still on board with that as well.
5. What if it was just good enough? What if it was just 4 cards for 1 4 mana spell?
I'm still on. Yep. Yeah, that I'm seems in. Like a rate okay. I'm comfortable
I'll
paying.
Take 3. Well, currently in 15% of artifact decks, 1 with the machine is only in that many. So if you'll notice, I had very specific numbers there. So I was just going down the signature cards for artifact decks. Darksteel Forge costs 9 mana. So 1 with the machine is just draw cards equal to the highest converted mana cost of any artifact you control. So if you have Darksteel Forge out, you draw 9 cards for 4 mana. Mirror Battlesphere, draw 7 cards for 4 mana. those are two very, they're both in over half of all artifact decks out there. Kaldorth the Forgemaster, draw five cards. And it doesn't have to be anything that you target either. It can be, you know, say you have your Darksteel Forge out, you want to draw nine, but then they exile it somehow. Oh no, I'm only drawing four because of my unwinding clock. That's still a very good ratio. You know, we talk all the time about how, you know, you guys don't like Phyrexian Arena, but what you both do like is stuff like Painful Truths, you know, those one-shot effects that get you three, four cards real quick. One with the Machine is that for your artifact decks.
Yeah. And even if they get rid of your biggest one, it just picks your next biggest one. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's not targeted. You have your Spine of Ishsaw. They, you know, make you get rid of it. You have your Trading Post out. You're still getting four cards for four mana. It's just a very good ratio. It's terribly, terribly underplayed for something that I know on the cast here, we were, you know, pretty keen on it. We weren't gushing about it like some cards, but One with the Machine, I think, is getting not near the love that it should be, especially for the incredible upside that it has. I mean, even if you're just, you know, drawing, you know, one card per mana, that's still great. And if you're an artifact deck, yeah, you're going to have a high concentration of cards to do. It's not very good after the Vandal Blast you, maybe, but chances are you're going to be able to reload pretty quick.
Yeah, if that's, like, the card doesn't do anything if you have been destroyed by people destroying all of your artifacts.
Yeah.
In that case, no, it does not help you catch back up. But what it does do is help you, like, find answers before people get the chance to play those spells. It's not, like, if worst case scenario is that you only draw three cards by casting a One with the Machine, and that's not worst case scenario. Obviously, the worst case scenario is you have nothing.
Yeah.
But if you only draw three cards with One with the Machine, it is a less color intensive version of the card Concentrate, which is a four mana sorcery to draw three cards. Mm-hmm. So that's excellent. Totally on board. But yeah, in an artifact deck, you're going to have targets for this. It's perfect.
Yeah. Only 15% of decks since it's come out have been playing it. And I think that is criminal how low of a ratio that is.
I am super on board. Love that pick. I like all of our picks this week, but that maybe that's me just being a little biased. I do kind of like us.
That's fair. We're all pretty great. Even though Matt is not allowed on my lawn.
Not allowed on my lawn. Oh my goodness. I want to wrap up with one final question, you guys. You have both mentioned that you have a Galissa deck, but I just wanted to ask what your favorite artifact commander is. We breezed by a couple of them at the top of the show, but is Galissa your favorite artifact commander, or do you like another one, or I don't know, just what are your thoughts when you're playing those decks?
Well, Galissa's the only artifact commander I've ever built, so as far as decks that I have actually had, like, in my position and played games with, Galissa by default. I still really like Joyra, Weatherlight Captain. I think she just is a snowball combo machine, kind of does what I would like to be doing out of artifact decks, but that's just me and my playstyle personally.
I really like Duretti a lot, ignoring Galissa, who I'm obviously biased towards as my commander. To play against artifact decks, I enjoy Duretti quite a bit. I think it's very interactive, and it's also very fair. Like, a Duretti deck can get out of control, but you have a window there where you can deal with it if you play good Magic. Whereas I feel like some of the other ones, like, I've seen those Braille lists and I've seen, you know, Arkham Dagsum decks and Charum decks where you don't have a window. If they get to six mana or seven mana or something and untap, they're just going to play their combo and win the game. Unless you're playing blue with counterfeit mana free, you've just lost the game. Duretti doesn't do that. Duretti has to, like, get itself there so you can respond and deal with it, interact in a way you kind of maybe can't with a super tuned Shroom deck or a super tuned Brea deck. So yeah, my vote would be for Duretti.
I like Duretti a lot too. I'm glad that you mentioned that one. I do have a soft spot for Brea just because I like that she represents, like, infinite potential to, like, do anything. But that also is kind of a mark against her because she can literally do anything. So I get decision paralysis about it.
Sure.
I really like the new Saheeli the Gifted, which is why I chose a challenge of stats for her, just because I like that she is, like, she does everything that I would want an artifact deck to do. She gets more of them. She helps you play them. Her ultimate is a great big fun blowout. But one that I want to mention really quick is Mishra Artificer Prodigy, because a buddy of mine has a Mishra deck and that thing's surprisingly nasty. Mishra is a really weird Grixis commander that actually says something that commander players should never want to see. Whenever you play an artifact spell, you may search your graveyard hand and or library for a card with the same name as that spell and put it into play. And if you search your library that way, then you shuffle it. Like, we're a singleton format. This shouldn't do anything, right? Well, the way that he plays it, he's doing things with spells like Thada Adel, for example, which when it hits you can steal an artifact from you. So then when he gets Thada Adel out and he hits you, he says, I'm going to play your soul ring, and then he gets his own soul ring. He does stuff like that in the deck, which is just really crazy. So I wanted to give a quick shout out to Mishra, because it, despite the fact that it looks like it would be crap in our particular format, it's actually surprisingly good. And that ultimately is what I think is so cool about artifacts. When you take a look at them, like, you see really big mana costs, and sometimes they look a little dirty, like 9 mana for a Darksteel Forge. But the cool thing about artifacts is how well they synergize with each other to make sure that any of those big hurdles that you've got to jump over are so much easier to jump over than they actually look. And that's just what's kind of cool about the whole strategy.
Yeah, it's a stacks, like, it's very unintuitive. Like, if you're playing with a bunch of newer players, it's not going to make sense how Mishra works. With people that do know how it works, they're going to know you can't let Mishra stick around for too long. Otherwise, you're just going to take over pretty quick.
That's probably true of a whole lot of these commanders.
That is
definitely
true
of Duretti. Yeah. Shroom is really dangerous. Bray is really dangerous. Like, the longer I look at these, I think I'm probably going to have to agree with your guys' assertion at the beginning of the show that really a lot of what it comes down to for the popularity of this particular strategy is its power level. These guys do some really crazy stuff, so I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about that. But, you know, with that, on that note, we're going to call this episode to a close. I'd like to thank you guys so much for joining me, and if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where can they find you all?
Well, you can find me on the Twitters at Mathimus55, M-A-T-H-I-M-U-S.
5-5.
5-5.
You can find me on Twitter at Dana Roach. You can find Matt not on my lawn. And you can hear me once a week on another show, Commander Central.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter, wondering whether I'm allowed on Dana's lawn, but probably not. I'm another youngin'. Weird joke aside, a special thanks to our editor for the show, Ken Peddle, also known as Kenneth Schnorn. You can follow him on Twitter at Loader, that's L-O-A-D-3-R. You can follow EDH Rec and the EDH Rec cast on Facebook and Twitter. We're doing a giveaway when EDH Rec gets 5,000 likes and when EDH Rec cast gets 1,000 followers on Twitter. So head on over there to smash those like buttons for a chance at a cool prize. You can also contact us at edhreccast@gmail.com and find us on iTunes. And if you do, please consider leaving us a review to help other folks find the podcast. This podcast is posted every week on our community content spotlight section, where we feature as many other content creators as we can, from Command Zone to Commander's Brew to Commander Versus, not to mention new articles published every day by our own fantastic team of writers. We'll be back at you next week with more data and insights, but until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.
Yeah, I mean, he can just use Moose lapping at his water for 30 seconds. Exactly.
And Dana trying desperately to be heard.
Right. Fighting to get heard over it. And I'll be straining louder and louder for no reason.
Listen to me, guys.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
We'll tell you, K is really good.
I have opinions.